Next page is 98-2386, Dorothy Vilat versus Stella Vilat.
Take this case in because I thought it was a good probate issue, and we don't get enough of the probate issues, and give us a chance to write on something. I'm going to give you a fair shot at me because now I don't see this to be a probate issue. To me, it's a simple contract issue, and I would probably decide it on Appellee's proposition of law number 2 or 3, 4, and 5, whatever they numbered it. Why wasn't it valid at the time the contract was drawn, and why should we alter contract law because it happens to be a surviving widow who might very well be entitled to this, or should maybe have it, but the contract says she doesn't get it? Why should we alter contract law because this is a probate case and because of the statute of wills?
The contract law and the case law of this court has cited or issued many years ago, Neal versus Neal. It says an executory contract, which it is. It's an executory contract. It's not a completed contract. It has testamentary language in there, which requires that the document be executed in the form of a will in order to validate the transfer.
Okay, well, let's equate that then to what we know as POD accounts, payable on death accounts. That's a executory contract. That only happens on death.
Right, but that's statutory provided. Transfer of property is either by statute or there's a vested interest. The statute of will provides for one method of transfer of property in the doctrine of property execution. Otherwise, in any kind of contractual form, it has to be an executed contract, even if there is a contract right in place. I think the law is clear on that point. This is not like an insurance application form where somebody is designated a beneficiary. Now, they may have a vested interest or they may not, depending upon whether there's a reservation of rights clause in the policy. But obviously, nothing happens to the debt of the person.
You mean if I have an account, which I don't, in a stockbroker, and I say that Justice Sweeney, who will thank me forever, Justice Sweeney gets it when I die. He doesn't have a right to do that? That's not a contract?
Well, the question is,
he's a beneficiary.
Okay, there are more to this case than I think just that. There was a surviving spouse who had a claim to
Say I've got a surviving spouse.
Yeah. Okay, well then the question becomes, when was that documentation? We're talking about retroactivity in this case. I think that's a major factor here. It was never addressed by the appellees. The Wendell versus the Merit Trust case is a linchpin case as far as we're concerned in this. Because the nature of this document, it has testamentary language. It has to be executed in the form of a will, otherwise it's invalid to transfer the property.
If that's the case, why shouldn't we follow the federal law on it? Federal law provides for this to be done. Provides for me to leave as my beneficiary of my broker's account, Justice Sweeney, as opposed to my surviving spouse, doesn't it?
We're talking about 26 U.S.C.
Mm-hmm.
408.
Yes, sir.
That's interesting. 26 U.S.C. 408 is a taxing statute, period.
Yes.
Either a trust or an IRA and a custodial account exists. This is not a trust. Absolutely not a trust. Nothing suggests a trust. In fact, 1709 says it is not a trust. In fact, 1709 was enacted in order to make this valid. So it's trying to create some retroactive rights with the Ohio Constitution, Article 2, Section 28 says it cannot, creating some new rights. And if I'm Fawson case, then Fawson case versus Babcock, which is court,
yeah, we know the Van...
Years ago, okay.
We know the Van Fossen case.
Van Fossen case.
When was 1709 passed?
1993.
Was that before or after this contract was entered into?
It was after this contract was entered into.
Okay. So you want us to make it retroactive, assuming that we forget all this other stuff. You want us to make it retroactive. Does that not divest somebody of a substantial right? And does that not then require the statute to say specifically it has to be retroactive? Pursuant to Van Fossen.
Well, as a matter of fact, I think it does divest the executrix of a right. Now, it creates a right. Van Fossen lists various ways, substantive right changes that occur that the retroactive provision of the Ohio Constitution prohibits changing substantive rights.
Mm-hmm.
Remedial rights, yes, but not substantive rights. And that's what is happening here if this court allows us to review. It's allowing the retroactive effect of this 1709 interfering with the rights of the executrix and creating a right that did not exist with Stella Vila.
How is, like, the Court of Appeals disagreed with you on that and said that there, what right, you know, what substantive right did, can you articulate that the statute, which does permit, or does make it retroactive, what right is, substantive right, is she denied? The right to inherit from her husband? No? I mean, that's not it, because he had a contract that said, you're not my beneficiary. So where's her right?
Well, the Van Fossen case, I think, is an answer.
Mm-hmm.
Because it gives rise to or takes away the right to sue or defend an action of law. She would have had a right to challenge what was happening.
Okay.
At the same time, creating a right in Stella Vila, it takes away a right to challenge what was invalid because of the retroactive effect of 1709 when it shouldn't apply.
Stella had a right by contract, right? Stella's rights come by virtue of the contract that her brother signed.
It's a contract, right? But not every contract is enforceable.
I mean, but that's really what you're saying, isn't it, Mr. McClellan? That it's that she, there's some right she would have otherwise had an ability to enforce in the future, but for this retroactive statute.
Right.
That's not what Van Fossen speaks of, is it?
Well, you have to interpret Van Fossen, but what was said is, or gives rise to, it gave rise to something whenever 1709 came into effect, validating something that was invalid before, clearly, because the 1709 says it's invalid. It's not a testamentary document, and she had no vested rights, and she was waiting there for something to happen. It's purely an executory contract. So anyhow,
if he had left his surviving spouse as the beneficiary, Would you include that as an asset on the, in the estate?
If it falls on the IRA agreement, yes, I think it would have been.
How? That bypasses probate. It's a direct it's a direct beneficiary, isn't it?
I do not think
so. You'd have paid the tax on it. You would have submitted it as part of the inventory.
I think it had to, unless it was more than 3 years prior. I'm not sure.
Would you do that? Would you do that with the, yeah, well, forget the contemplation of death. Would you do that if it was a policy of insurance with Prudential Insurance?
I think it's another matter.
Okay.
Because
but the question is, would you include that in the inventory of the estate?
No.
Okay.
Not unless it's payable to the estate.
Exactly. And this was not payable to the estate.
It's not payable to an estate. It's payable to an individual. It isn't even entered for tax purposes, less than a third of them.
All right. Let's go to the next step. Do you take your PODs and put them in the inventory? Ms. Stella's the POD?
I think it's outside.
It's outside of the taxing statute and the inventory, isn't it?
It should be taxed, but it isn't part of the estate.
It may be taxed individually to her. It's not taxed in the estate.
Depending upon who gets it.
All right. Then how do all of these other examples differ from the fact that you have this contract that says, I own this, and when I die, I give it to this person?
Well, it depends on the document that says that you transfer it. And that's what this case is all about. If it's a valid document, like in the Schilling case, that was an insurance company matter. It was a valid document, but if it came vested when it was anxiety, obviously there's a claim there. But this document does not transfer it without being formally
if that were the case, then there'd be no way to transfer ownership to the beneficiary. So it'll float around in limbo. If your proposition is correct, the securities dealer cannot sign the transfer of securities form. You'd have to have a certificate of death, but you'd have to have more than that. You'd have to have like a certificate to transfer the real estate to transfer to a beneficiary, so to an heir. Well, how do you get this transferred?
Well,
obviously, yes. How are they going to transfer it? How is the securities broker to transfer it to their client?
Well, what would happen if this had been challenged within the law, and the executrix or the executor of the estate would issue a certificate. A document allowing the funds to be transferred to Stella Vila.
Wait a minute. The executor of the estate does? If it isn't an estate, if it's not an
estate. The estate would provide necessary documents.
All they need is a death certificate. All you need is a death certificate. You don't need an order of the probate court to transfer assets that don't go through the estate, do you? Where is it now?
Where is it now? The funds are being held by Merrill Lynch, awaiting the outcome of this case.
Okay. And if we affirm in this case, you think the executor has a role to play in authorizing the transfer?
I think that's how this case got started. I was contacted by an attorney representing the Stella Vila, asking me to provide who the executor was, ready to get this authorization for the transfer of funds standing in his name of death to the main beneficiary. That's how it got started. That's when we got to look at this document and say, hey, this document isn't good. It can't be determined who gets the assets.
You know it's good, other than you want to say that the law that permits it to be good that retroactive law is, you think that's your only real argument, that it's no good. It's just the retroactivity of the law, because the law makes it good.
The law would invalidate this document and allow the law to stand at the time that will was executed. That's what the Wendell versus Merit Trust case is about.
Mm-hmm.
And a whole line of cases going back to 1850, the body of law has declared that the law in effect at the time will execute it should apply.
But except here we have the law made retroactive by the General Assembly, right? This law is made retroactive.
This is General Assembly.
So unless you're right about this being some substantive right being created, unless you're right about that, your case, that your whole case falls, rises or falls on that, doesn't it?
There was a right created.
Well, I'm saying that is the key. Unless you're right about that, you lose.
Yes, I think that's the essence of this case.
Mm-hmm.
If we can't set aside this document and look at the laws of existence, because then the money would go right into the estate. About 1709, the law of these assets.
But 1709 is retroactive.
Mr. Ritchie.
Good morning. My name is Frank Ritchie, and I represent the Applebee's Stella B-Led in this matter. We've talked this morning concerning the law pertaining to Chapter 1709. I have the issue framed as whether Chester Belas' designation of his sister as beneficiary to the IRA contract become void as a testamentary instrument. That's where we must start our analysis. First of all, is in fact this IRA contract a testamentary instrument? And I submit to you that it is not a testamentary instrument. There has been several cases decided that indicate that an IRA contract should be interpreted as any other contract. In fact, this court in Kinkle versus Kinkle assessed a contract, an IRA contract. In fact, assessed the beneficiary clause of an IRA contract.
But that argument, it doesn't really matter what that analysis in that the statute takes care of it and says it is not testamentary retroactively, right?
Well, it
says these sort of contracts are to be treated as not testamentary.
Right. I don't believe that what I believe Chapter 1709 did is simply codify the existing state of the law, okay, so that it did not really have retroactive application to effectuate something that was sent out. I believe that it was valid from the get-go.
And if you find it to be a valid contract at the get-go, as you say, as its inception.
It's beginning, right? Or inception.
Yeah.
Yes.
At its inception, then you never get to 1709, do you?
That's correct. But if we were to assume, and this is an important point as well, if we were to assume that the appellant's argument is correct, that it is a testamentary instrument that was not executed with the formalities of the will, that argument is a double-edged sword. Because if, in fact, it is a testamentary instrument, then it comes to life only when the testator passes away, just like a will. In fact, this court has said that as to the operation and effect of a will, that law is the law that is governing at the time of death. As to the meaning of a will, when the testator says, I give to my best friend, Chris, you look back to the time of execution to find out who the best friend of Chris was.
Did you have a shot, if you will? You make a contract with self-shot to just pay. If you die before that contract is executed, is the executive and delegation to do that contract?
I believe that an executor does have the obligation to complete contracts of the testator.
The contract doesn't become void because it will be executed like a will.
That's correct. Any contract does not need to have a witnessing requirement. So if this is a contract, then that would go back to the original argument that it does not need to be witnessed and it is valid from its inception.
Well, my rebuttal was
again from the argument that was set forth in E.F. Hutton, and that was a case by a federal appellate court, State Circuit, and found that an IRA contract beneficiary designation is no different than a beneficiary designation of an insurance policy. I would equate them on the same terms, yes. And in fact, that court did find that, and that was a holding in the case.
So I think I understand what you argued just previously. Let me put it in a different form. I understand what you're advancing with respect to this new statute. For example, the will in Ohio is supposed to be signed by the testator and the witness by the individual. I take it that your argument is the legislature changed that law and said the will of a valid will in Ohio needs to be signed by the testator and the witness by the individual.
Right. In fact, this court has said that the ask of operation and effect of a will, that the law in place at the time of the testator set is what is controlling at that time.
In terms of the formal requirements for that will.
Well, yes, and as to its effect and operation.
It's really as to rights to inherit, isn't it?
But yes, this and why it's important, rights to inherit, is because we do need to talk about that. A will, until the testator passes away, is merely a sheet of paper with ink on it. It only carries rights, and only vests rights in the beneficiaries or in the heirs who are named in the will. Upon the passing of that person, Mr. Leland passed away in 1996. Chapter 1709 was passed or was enacted in 1993. So this statute, if it has any effect at all, is prospective in nature. Likewise, with any rights that there may be in the Stella Leland, if in fact we say that IRA was testamentary as authority by the appellant, that's why it's a double-edged sword. If it's testamentary, no rights were created in Stella Leland until 1996, when Mr. Leland passed away. The statute is already in effect, therefore it has prospective application. I don't believe so, because when there is a beneficiary designation, and we touched on this issue, there is the asset does not go to probate court. If it is governed, if the asset does have to go to probate, then rights of surviving spouse, the left against the will, etc., those types of rights would apply to probate assets. That brings up an interesting policy question. Is the appellant's argument today asks that all IRA contracts executed prior to 1993, and there's a boatload of them, would have invalid beneficiary designation. Everybody who thought that we were avoiding probate by the naming of a beneficiary will not have a large asset included in their probate estate if this court were to rule to be a
just for purposes of writing this case, when we get to it, you designate in your brief, and the trial court did in its entry, that this is an IRA. Is that technically correct?
It is an individual retirement account set up in custodial form. According to USC 26, section 408, it is to be treated as a trust under that particular statute.
What is the document itself headed? What is it entitled? Does it say IRA like IRA accounts do?
I believe it does inside of the document.
Okay, because I looked at the cover page and it doesn't seem to be an IRA. But I just want to be sure for purposes. Okay. Do you believe, given the trial court's opinion and the Court of Appeals affirming, do you agree with your learned adversary that if we affirm, that you've got to go ask the executor to transfer this?
If you would affirm, what would occur is that that asset would be simply an asset owned by the deceased and would go to the deceased's estate and be probated, and it would go under the terms of the will.
No, if we affirm.
If you affirm,
bad enough without you helping us any.
I apologize. If you affirm, what would occur is that Stella B. could make a claim to Merrill Lynch.
Directly to Merrill Lynch.
That's correct.
Wouldn't have to call the executor up.
What does need to occur is what's called a tax waiver.
Yeah, sure.
That, I believe, is signed by the executor, so you probably would have the executor or somebody, some appropriate party would have to sign off on the tax release. Perhaps the claimant. I can't recall that.
Only to discharge it from the estate do you need that tax waiver is what you're talking about.
Well,
okay, yeah. But you contemplate going to Merrill Lynch and saying, give us the money.
Yes. Any further questions? Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Witchie. Mr. Whelan, you save 30 seconds.
That's true. There's no evidence at all in this case that this was greatly disturbed by IRS because the precise set of facts we have here has never been shown. This is the way most of them are. Sister name, set of life. But we're not challenging either the validity of IRAs except in this particular account. And Kinkle versus Kinkle and the EFF cases, when you read those cases carefully, they have nothing to do with this case. The facts in those cases are totally different and not applicable at all to the precise set of facts we have here. And then lastly, there's no other way that these funds can get transferred other than a valid testamentary approach to the document or otherwise that the law would provide for it. It can't go back retroactively and make something valid or invalid on the side. That's what this case is all about. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.